And good evening. It is Intuitive Soul Radio with your host, Lori Houston. And this is the second portion of our evening tonight where I get to interview an author. And tonight we are blessed with Susan Halpern, who has written the book, Finding the Words, Candid Conversations with Loved Ones. Welcome, Susan.
Hello, Lori. It's nice to talk to you.
It is. And we were just sort of discussing that, you know, we both have a background in social work, which makes a nice connection.
Yes.
So tell me a little bit about, you know, what your journey has been and why you got to where you are and you wanted to write this book, Finding the Words.
Oh, it's a long and winding tale. I'll see if I can keep it alive and bright. I got a kind of cancer in 1995 called lymphoma. And I dealt with lymphoma for several years. And as a social worker, I began facilitating support group for people with cancer, having left another job that wasn't as well suited at that point in my life. And through that experience, I heard a lot of stories, and I heard two main issues that kept arising for different people. That is, how touched they were, the people, those of us who are sick, when someone gets in touch with us and wishes us well, and how hard it is to call or write our friends when we hear they have a diagnosis and we don't know what to say. So I wanted those two parts of each of us and all of us to hear each other. So having never thought I'd write a book, never wanting to write a book, I mostly wrote grocery lists and resented memo writing and case writing, I began realizing I wanted to write these stories of different people and how they were touched and what they found to say and do with loved ones and people they didn't know so well and around different kinds of illnesses, and especially talking to children when parents are ill or talking to parents at the end of life.
Right.
So it's a generational thing, and it's multiple kinds of conversations. And I had these little conversations in it, as I do in this book. Simple phrases people can use. I'm so sorry this happened to you. And people who seemed totally articulate and educated and fluent were calling me and saying, that really helped. I didn't know what to say to Joe. And I finally, after 6 months, picked up the phone and called him because of your book. So that was very pleasing to me.
Mm-hmm.
And my mind began, continued, it didn't begin, it continued, hearing life in terms of these vignettes that touch people and where they find the words. And I found myself very stuck with my own mother, helping her recognize she was too old to drive. So that was my first story that I wrote for this book, just to see how it would come out and what I needed to say. And I talked about in the book my own doubts and how badly I did it the first time and I had to come back to mother and try again. And I thought, well, you know, it was sort of fun writing last time, and it was certainly fun touching a few people, and maybe I should do that some more. I'm now in my 60s. I've moved to Berkeley to be near my grandchildren, and while I have a volunteer job in the social work field I love, I also like writing. And so this book grew out of that one very clearly for me into a broader field of general conversations with loved ones, with partners, with siblings, with adult children, and adult children with parents. It goes both ways. Mm-hmm. And then again with people at the end of life, both partners and the next generation that's dealing with the older people.
Right.
So I had a lot of fun again. Another book.
Well, it certainly is, you know, it's a little bit different than what most people even think about. And it brings up a lot of, you know, it brings up a lot of really clear thoughts and ideas for people that, you know, we really, again, we don't think about these things. We don't think about, you know, how do we resolve issues around siblings? How do we not get into disputes when there's, you know, a state that needs to be divided? How do we, you know, all of these things you sort of mentioned in your book. And I think, you know, we tend to sort of concentrate either on one relationship, which is the romantic relationship we're in, and you know, and you delve into that quite nicely, and we'll probably spend probably a good portion of it talking about different ideas and what you came to. But, you know, what I really liked is, you know, the way you came from a compassionate heart, and that you found with yourself that that's really the place that you have to be.
Well, that's why I'm pleased to be on your show, because from what I read about you, you also care very much about the connection between people, the spirit that connects, and the heart.
Mm-hmm.
And a friend described my book in a way I'd like to say, and that
Please.
He says it's a diamond. At the bottom, the root, the core, the foundation is love. And it's love that gives rise to the desire to have these conversations in a useful way that's productive and kind and maintains or increases the intimacy. And the conversations are at the top of the diamond. And then the broad middle part is all the listening, accepting, compassion. And I just thought, oh, thank you. Thank you for defining it that way. I really like that. So I'm glad to have a chance to put that out.
Yeah, because
yes, it is the love that forms the basis and that we want to protect. We can't just charge in like mad bulls in a china shop when we want to talk about a difficult subject. We need to think about it first.
Right, right. And you also talk about the fact that even though you've been in an almost 50-year marriage, that, you know, there are still times that you have to, you know, let go and resolve and have mitigation and, of course, the most important thing, laughter.
Yes, I really think that's important, that people not have an expectation that they'll get it right and they'll stop quarreling. It's not going to happen.
Mm-hmm.
You'll do it differently. I do it differently. It lasts for less time, the period of strain. And we now have techniques for coming out the other side
mm-hmm.
that feel nourishing and rewarding and kind.
Mm-hmm.
And then I love him more.
Uh-huh. That's so beautiful. and it's true. I mean, if you come from that place, and when you discuss topics that, you know, feel uncomfortable, and let's face it, we all have those times where we feel uncomfortable. And usually when we feel uncomfortable, instead of talking about it, instead of communicating about it, instead of coming from a place of the heart, we come from this place that we are, you know, either trying to stuff it down, or we go into our addictions and we emotionally eat so that we don't have to deal with it, or we turn on the TV so that we don't have to deal with it. We do all these things that we do to get ourselves out of that uncomfortable place so that we don't have to actually get there to discuss it.
Yeah. The desire to be right, to make the other wrong, can get quite predominant. There's the silence. There's the withdrawal, as you've described it. And I've done all those, as have most of us. And then there's the I'll get you.
Yeah. Yeah. Gotta love that. And it's just our fear, because it's our fear of our beliefs, you know, that we're not lovable and acceptable for who we are.
Yes, and so much of that anger when we plumb to the depths of it. And there's one very simple example. He doesn't pick up his socks, therefore he doesn't love me.
Mm-hmm.
That's in the book. And it took the woman time to descend in through the layers of feelings to, my fear is he doesn't love me. He knows I care about this. How can he do this to me? And for her to discover it's really this irrational fear. The man shows love in 800 other ways. It's recognizing that underneath the anger and the whatever is going on, the noise, underneath her noise is fear. And when she recognizes that, she can let go of it.
Wow.
And that's often the case.
Yeah. Yeah. It really is. And yeah, I mean, I think it's just important that we recognize some of the things that sort of block us from, you know, from having that heart connection, from, you know,
mm-hmm.
being,
mm-hmm.
go into that vulnerability, speak the truth, and, you know, and understand that anger is a natural, authentic emotion that is okay.
Yeah, so I like that point. And too often, too many of us, more women than men, are raised with the idea that if we get angry, we've been bad.
Mm-hmm. Oh, it's very
prevalent. It's an emotion. It's how we express it, how we handle it, how cruel we get with it, and how soon we acknowledge I'm angry. Simply saying I'm angry to me is much cleaner than the spraying and rattling on that can go with it. It's just, this makes me angry.
Yeah.
And then talk can happen.
Mm-hmm.
Or maybe it takes another day till the conversation can happen. That's okay, too.
Yeah. Yeah. And, you know, it's sometimes probably even better, because by the time you can acknowledge that you're angry, you're probably pretty angry, which probably is a good idea to sort of...
Wait till the next day, yeah.
Yeah.
Yes, to because during that period, what I suggest in the book and in life is to see what my part is in the exchange. What happened? What was I saying? How was I looking? What tone of voice did I use? How did I make this thing get so confrontive? And then, when we come together after an angry time, and I use myself just because that's how I talk. When we come together and I own my part, it puts my partner in the place of having to look at his part. And it's so much easier to say, oh, I'm sorry, because I am at that point when I see what I've done, sorry, when I can hear him finding his place with what he did that he wasn't comfortable with, rather than the blame and the pointing of a finger. This is what you did. This is what you said. Apologize now. It's much clearer, cleaner, and easier to come to a place of harmony if I say, yeah, I was very crabby at that moment. I didn't have to be so crabby.
Right.
I'm sorry.
Yeah.
And then I get the same back. Sometimes.
Vice
versa. Yeah, I mean, it's not that simple.
Not always,
but
yes.
That helps.
Yeah, it does. So you kind of mentioned it, and I think that this is a big area for a lot of relationships, and, you know, certainly because it's been the situation that's been happening kind of globally right now and for the last year and a bit is, you know, the economy on relationships. And I think, you know, a lot of relationships break up because of financial problems or, you know, the big area that this creates. And you know, how are you helping people deal with this?
I wrote about this as the market was going down in, I guess, 2008. And it was very interesting to reflect on. It didn't touch my life directly, happily, or my children's. But I saw it around me so much, and I thought about these young couples who are getting started in life with young children and houses and mortgages, and the main breadwinner loses their job. And a woman who thought she'd stay home with her children goes to work and has to be the main breadwinner. And she comes home tired and strung out at the end of a day and has to do more than she'd like to. And how do they keep that spark of love alive? How does she continue to be in relationship with her husband when she wishes he were working?
Mm-hmm.
I don't think I used that example directly, but I think that's probably the main one. And I think it takes a lot of talk between the couple, more than usual, about responsibilities in the home that can be shared, ways that her efforts can be matched by his efforts so that she doesn't feel she's all alone carrying this family. And they need to come back, and he needs to talk about his vulnerability, being a man without a job. Or reverse the sexes, same thing. Whoever was the breadwinner, if they stop being the breadwinner and someone else the other partner has to step in. It needs, every month or so, I would think, a renewed discussion. Can we keep doing this? A kind of trust and faith that comes from some acceptance of what is. Mm-hmm. And that this is what's on our plate right now. How are we going to deal with it as well as possible?
Right.
Because at some point it becomes very frustrating for a person to look for work, and they give up some, and then that's a strain.
Yeah.
So it's a retreat from the everyday, just let it go on, habituated patterns. It's a real shifting in many, many ways, and not in a make-do way, but let's make this work that I think the conversation has to be around.
Mm-hmm.
That's all I can think of right now. More woke up perhaps come to me in the course of the hour.
Yeah. But I do, you know, I think it's important. I think it's very easy these days to get a divorce, and I think a lot of people give up long before, you know, they try, you know, to keep it together, and they give up for all sorts of different reasons. But I do know that, you know, financial crises seem to impact relationships the most, and in ways that, you know, people find very uncomfortable to talk about, because, you know, when our basic survival is at stake, you're in a state of fear. I mean, we can go to Maslow's basic, you know, I mean, it truly is. When you're not able to meet, you know, your basic needs, then it causes so much concern for people. And a lot of this, and I'm glad it didn't affect you, because I think a lot of it has been made. I think a lot of it has, the fear of it happening is often worse than, or more than it actually happening. And I hear a lot of people say, well, you know, will I be okay? And it's like, well, you know, why are you focusing on that? Well, you're focusing on that because it's everywhere in the media. Everybody is talking about it. Everybody is making it a big deal.
But until it happens, live your life.
Exactly.
That's what you're saying. It's just like with illness, before you know what the diagnosis is, the fears can be enormous. But if you're feeling okay today, just live today.
Yeah.
You'll find the diagnosis out in 2 weeks, then you'll deal with it.
Mm-hmm.
Similarly with job loss, I think talking about fear is very, very hard for most of us. And that's the area that needs to be explored and shared, because then the comforting and the compassion arise. And it's from that place that couples can stay connected.
Right.
So it's revealing the fears, the anxiety to each other.
Right. Because that opens you up.
Form the bond.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, that really opens you up to allowing that vulnerability that you spoke of to create that bond, to create a deeper intimacy.
And it's an unaccustomed place.
Yeah.
But it's a place from which growth will come in a relationship and make it possible to stay together.
Yeah.
I had a friend who was a really sick husband early in their marriage, and he would never be able to work again.
Mm.
And he wasn't bedridden or anything. It was a balance issue. Mm. And people said to her, how come you stayed? You could have left. She said, I wouldn't leave him at this time. I wouldn't leave him. And that attitude is not in everyone.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah, definitely. So, let's talk about a few of your chapters in your book. And you know, a lot of what you did talk about is relationships and how to deal with them. So, cultivating conscious conversations as a couple. You know, what to say when you're furious?
that's my opening chapter, mm-hmm. my opening vignette, as you know. And that comes from a very early communications theory workshop. And again, it's what we talked about before, that the conversation perhaps should not take place in the moment of rage, but someone say, this is getting ugly, let's talk tomorrow, or let's let this settle down and come back to it in a few hours, or I can't talk about this now, let me think about it. Just something to make a pause. And then the principles, the practice, as I've written it and think about it and use it in a softer form, but the underlying thing is to figure out and then state what are our thoughts, our feelings, our intentions, and our desires or plan of what we want. That is complete communication. That tells the other person where you're at. It also is a very intellectual exercise, and so it slows down the emotional flow.
Yeah.
By then, usually the thinking and the emotions are rather known, but the intention, my intention was not to hurt you with this. My intention was to say, and then something completely different from what the other person thought was going on had been her intention or his intention, and their ears perk up, and they hear the whole exchange differently, and that happens so often. And then the desire is, I want us to get along, usually, or I want this to happen, or I don't want this to happen again, or the intention of how to move forward next time can come up in that point. So it's thoughts, feelings, intention, and desire for the future. Now, it's not enough to just do that. There's a whole package around it. That is finding a nice, gentle time and place to talk together. Not while he's brushing his teeth and can't hear you over the sound of the toothbrush, or when she's making breakfast for the children and packing the lunches and is thinking about going to work. It has to be a time that's safe and quiet and feels good. Now, some couples like to face each other and make eye contact. Some people can't handle that degree of contact in the time of still being angry, and it's helpful if they sit side by side. Then the attitude of listening, and I love these words, is with curiosity and interest. It's not with that edge. It's not with that gripping, holding on to the anger. It's listening with curiosity and interest. Who is this person I live with? What are they experiencing? How can I hear them better? And bringing that attitude by parties, I mean, it's such a different experience for people. So that's what I tried to get across in that early section.
Yeah, and I think, you know, you mentioned some key points. You know, a lot of the times, you know, we get stuck, but, you know, knowing what you want, so knowing what your intention was and then thinking about what your desire is, I mean, that is so huge for most people, because we don't realize why we do things sometimes. And, you know, sometimes there really is a poor part of us that says, well, you hurt me, so I want to hurt you back. And that, and that's okay to even admit, if you can admit it and see it. But you need to sometimes be a little bit more aware. So that's the conscious part of what you're talking about when we talk about, you know, having conscious conversations.
Yes, exactly. I mean, there's many, many times for spontaneity in our lives. But if there's an area of difficulty, it needs attention and consciousness. And consciousness, as you describe it, and I think of it, is a kind of witnessing of our own behavior. It's not being trapped in it. It's, oh, that's what I did. That's what I said. Oh, that's how I sounded. It's that looking at ourselves using our conscious mind.
Yeah. And the other thing you talked about was perception. I think perception is huge, because we think when something is happening that what they're doing is they're doing something to us. And so we have this perception of what and why and, you know, what the emotion around what they're saying and what they're thinking. We make up this story in our mind of what it is that's going on. And so when you can actually have a candid conversation that's more conscious about, which means you're understanding yourself, then that helps you then reflect better to see that perception is what caused the problem in the first place.
Now, I said early in this piece of our conversation that I do it less formally in person, something to that effect. That is, there's a very stilted, I am thinking, I am feeling, I am intending, where we don't talk that way in life. And it needn't come out that way, and it needn't come out in order.
Right.
And after a couple has done the four aspects many times, they may just go to one aspect, which they feel is most useful in that moment. Mm-hmm. These are to be utilized in whatever way works. It's not formulaic.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's important.
And kindness. I like the words consciousness and kindness. Yeah. How is it that we can be so mean to people we love more than to ordinary other people?
Yeah. And then how
and
is it?
I don't think it's just me.
No.
I don't think I'm alone in this one. But angry words come out.
Yeah. And then how is it that we can be the worst to ourselves?
Yeah.
You know, we wouldn't treat our best friend the way we treat ourselves.
Mm-hmm. Yes, that's so true. Yes. Yeah, so that after after some kind of angry exchange or silent and withdrawn exchange, there can be a lot of guilt on the part of the person who realizes they've done it again.
Yes.
And that also needs to be listened to with gentleness and curiosity and compassion. We need to be more compassionate to ourselves. And I think as we find that place, which I've come to through meditation, it's much easier to do it with others.
Mm-hmm.
If I find that I can say, okay, I started thinking during meditation, thoughts arising. Be gentle. Gently come back to the breath. Gently come back to the breath. That has taught me so much about being kinder to myself.
Mm. Yeah, that's...
I take it you're a meditator, too.
I am, definitely. Yeah.
Yeah. And your listeners, I think.
Yes. Okay, the other one that I liked in this chapter was, how can we stop having arguments? And I'm not sure that that's actually a possibility, because I think
yes,
it means you're healthy, but...
I'm picturing the woman that said that to me. She also had been married a very, very long time. And said, how long is this going to go on? And I think as long as we're intimately connected and care desperately about each other, passion, a passionate connection includes the negative and the positive.
Yes.
And we just have to learn how to move from one to the other, from the negative to the positive. We have to recognize it's part of the human experience and then move forward. Mm. And that the anger expresses some part of the, I want you to be just like me. How could you think that? That's engagement.
Yeah.
And if noted as, oh, listen to how passionate we are, it can become funny. And that's a way to move from negativity into humor. Oh, this fight again, number 37. There are 100 ways. I have some friends who have initials for the different arguments they have, so that if it's a take out the garbage, it'll be T-O-T-G. Oh, T-O-T-G again. And then they're often laughing. So people work out ways to do this. And I don't think the negativity is going to disappear.
Mm-hmm.
Because we are so connected. And there's so many ups and downs. Nothing is permanent. Emotions come and go.
Right.
Let's just find our way to joy more often.
Yeah. Yeah. And that comes to the second chapter, which is, how can I find my way to loving acceptance? And I think that's a really key place. That's a really key understanding to get to.
Yes, how can I, there comes a point, 10 years, 15 years, out of 7 years, maybe some people are really good at it earlier, of saying, oh, this, I'm going to use he again because I'm a woman, but this is who he is. This is how he moves in life. That isn't going to change, and I'm going to live with him. And I may as well accept it, or I'm going to make myself miserable, thinking I can't accept it. I'm going to be fidgety all the time. So he moves slowly. Okay, I move quickly. It's just two different ways. I want him to accept me. I can accept him. And it isn't easy, and it isn't smooth. And over the years, I find more and more areas that I hadn't been accepting of that I could be, and he also. But it's part of the getting to know. And acceptance is so much easier than discomfort and prickly. And why wouldn't we choose it? And yet we don't automatically go to acceptance.
Right.
So I just want to remind people. And one of the things I say about the book is there's nothing terribly new in it. I just want to bring forth people's best selves and help them remember the things they've done that have worked and the things that feel good, and that it's okay to feel good. It's okay to love and express your love, and that it nourishes both of you to do it. Because sometimes those things get lost. So it's just a reminder kind of book.
Mm-hmm. And it does it beautifully. So I really liked one of the segments, which is, because I get this a lot as an intuitive, why can't you read my mind?
Yeah. That's one I read aloud at readings sometimes because it strikes such a chord with people. That's a difference that often occurs in couples where one is a mind reader and the other isn't. And so the couple I write about I saw in therapy. And what came out was fascinating to me. She wanted her mind to be read as she read his. How can he not know I want a foot massage right now? And he admitted after many years, he'd never said this to her before, but in a safe place, he could say, I don't like it when you do that, and sometimes you're wrong, and I don't correct you. And so you think you're right, and it continues. And the reason I don't read your mind is because I feel intruded on, and my privacy's invaded when you do it, and I don't want to do that to you. And they were able to listen to each other and hear this vast difference and finally understand why it hadn't been working. So she backed off, and he stopped twitching about being misread. She stopped having expectations that he would read her mind, and the area, the whole area, just settled down for them. But I found his explanation sounded so true for people, those who don't want to be read and those who do. Some of us want to be born with a twin who can read our minds, and some of us would hate that. So those are differences.
Yeah. And
that are built in, just built in.
Yeah.
They're not going to change much.
Yeah. And I think a lot of times, you know, there are a lot of women, and I think it's, you know, maybe the way we were brought up in that, you know, we would be rewarded for being good, or we would be rewarded for being quiet, or we would be, you know, our parents would know what was going on. And, you know, we were told to be the good girl and to you know, to be seen but not heard. And, you know, all of those things that we were sort of taught as children, especially as girls. And, you know, our parents seemed to know what we wanted. And so I think we grew up expecting the same thing, that expecting that our partner would know how to touch us, or expecting that our partner would know, you know, when we needed to be alone or when we wanted, you know, to have a connection. Like, I think it's amazing how many women there are in these kind of situations.
That's interesting. I've certainly heard of that kind of situation where the expectation is that's how people relate. They know. But then the other side of it is my friend who felt completely ignored as a child and went out into nature and sought her connection in nature and then had no expectation of connection from people and had to learn it.
Right.
Kind of study. And later she came to appreciate her parents for giving her the space, but at the time she felt neglected. And then there's the child that needs to read the parent because the parent is so self-absorbed that they don't see the child, and the child has to learn to read the parent so they don't get attacked or put down or ignored or some kind of strange disruptive behavior that they feel responsible for, probably aren't responsible for, but have to know how to creep around. There's also that kind of setup. And then what does that person bring to a an intimate relationship with a peer? They're probably really good mind readers.
Probably.
The Drama of the Gifted Child, is that the name of that book?
Yeah.
Years ago. Yeah.
Yeah.
So there are many different ways it can go, but if we come with the expectation that if we're good and quiet and nice, someone will read us, woo! It doesn't happen often. Someone had a really good parent. Blessings on both of them.
Or, you know, really good parent telling you to be quiet and good, and then every once in a while you got what you wanted. But yes.
That's true. And they're telling you you were good when you didn't feel good inside.
Yeah.
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 And it didn't fit. It didn't work right.
Now, the other part of this chapter was when you talked about, you know, and I, a lot of this relates to women, I think, more than men, but not all completely. But, you know, how letting out our anger, You know, is that going to make things worse? And how to learn how to say no without hurting the other person? Because we assume that if we say no, it means it's going to hurt somebody.
Yes, I'm so glad you raised that, but you know it's in the book, so thank you for that one. I think that's so important, and particularly for women, sexist comment again, but it isn't nice to say no.
Right.
That's the message that goes with the be a good girl.
Mm-hmm.
And what I learned recently, around the time I was writing my book, is a beautiful way to do that, which is to affirm the relationship, state the no in terms of oneself, and affirm the relationship again. So it goes like this. I'm going to have to say no, and I don't want this to hurt our relationship. I'm saying no because it really doesn't work for me at this time to take on that extra job, and I have to say yes to myself first.
Yeah.
So it's yes to the relationship, yes to myself first, no to whatever you have to say no to, and then again, and that doesn't mean I don't love you. It means I still love you, and I love me too. And that giving permission to oneself to put oneself first is so novel.
Yeah.
It just made my head spin around. Oh, that's what it takes to get to that place of saying no.
Right.
It's saying yes to me. So I want everyone to hear that. A man named Bill Urey came up with that, and I will attribute it to him.
Nice. It's true, though. And even recently I was talking with somebody and, you know, they were talking with a woman who had had a breakup and, you know, she says, well, you know, how do I stop loving him? And his response, which I thought was, you know, quite brilliant, he goes, you love yourself more.
Wow. Yeah, it's the same kind of thinking and feeling.
Yeah.
You love yourself more.
Because you can't really stop loving somebody.
No, and that's beautiful that she can still love him.
Mm-hmm.
And hopefully it's not, it probably is a very painful love at this point.
Yeah.
But we get addicted to that, too.
Oh, we do.
Yeah.
We do, yes. Yeah. So your next chapter is about accepting differences, and... one of your thoughts about is, don't you have any feelings? I like that. Again, making some assumptions and some expectations there. But, you know, I mean, we do need to look at, you know, accepting differences. I mean, we're going to, the spice of life is knowing that we're not all the same. We're all so unique.
It's that, again, that listening and taking in who the person is and how they express their feelings and which areas of feelings matter to them and which they just don't get involved in, and accepting that. And I used as an example in the book grieving, because mm-hmm. grieving is so different for each of us, and every way we do it is our way, and that has to be okay. And that was what got this couple in trouble, was that she felt he wasn't grieving for his mother properly.
Right.
And he wasn't terribly expressive of his feelings generally by her standards and her expectations. And again, it's that situation where expectations get in the way, that he needs to be expressive. And this is a very big... if this is a big area of difference, this is something that will split couples up. And an expanded way that I think of that is, it's not just the expression of feelings and the having of feelings, but the desire to communicate the feelings, which is a form of intimacy, an act of verbal form of intimacy, is to share feelings. And if people are at very, very different levels in that need for intimacy, that really does become a nearly unworkable situation. That, I think, is a really hard one to learn to accept. It means that one person has to turn outside the marriage or relationship to friends, often of the same sex, to find that kind of intimacy they need to feed them and nourish them, in order to accept the person who's very, very different. And the person who's more private and doesn't express and doesn't show has to accept that the sociable, expressive one does that. And that can be very difficult, different levels of intimacy and need of intimacy.
Yeah.
In a relationship.
Yeah. And
people do it.
Oh, they do.
People, you know.
They do.
Lots. I don't know how happy they say the relationship is, but for various reasons they want to keep it going.
Right.
And it's a different kind of exchange that happens with them. And mm-hmm. this woman in the vignette was not happy with her husband not mourning for his mother a certain way. And it was making her very uncomfortable. It was then her issue. It wasn't his issue. He was okay about his mother, and he was annoyed with her nagging.
Right.
I think I'll leave that one there.
Yeah. And you know, I've known couples where, you know, the woman, you know, says it's okay in the relationship. And then it's not just the same sex people that she goes to for, you know, that intimacy. And even though it's not sexual anyway, but going to the opposite sex to getting that connection that she's missing. And then, you know, somehow convincing herself that that's okay.
Oh, because she needs it. Yes, and then it does lead to sex, and it does lead sometimes
sure.
to divorce because that intimacy need gets to be met. And so to do it with the opposite sex is more tempting and challenging.
Oh, yeah, definitely.
And people need to be aware they're making that choice.
Yeah.
That if they want to stay married, that they're treading in dangerous territory.
Yeah. Yeah. I thought you brought up an interesting point in this chapter, which is, you know, how can I compromise when I'm so afraid?
Oh. How can I? Yes, that fear of losing one's last tidbit of personal strength or integrity or something. How can I give up what I want when I feel like I have so little? That, I think, is also a common feeling.
Yeah.
I'm trying to remember what the story was that went with that, but I could make one up on the spot. It probably had to do with time, recreational time. People's desires in that area are very different, too. Sometimes in a marriage, some people are joined at the hip and they do everything together on all their free time, and others do a lot of very separate things and a lot have very different needs for sociability or time alone, depending on the kind of work they do and the kind of person they are.
Mm-hmm.
And so if a person's feeling, let us say, that she never gets enough time alone and there are always demands on her and she doesn't want to socialize one more Saturday evening, she wants to stay home with a book, and she's rather at the end of her rope, and her husband says, this one's really important to me, I really want to see so-and-so, and he's in town visiting. For her to come, or he even, to come to a place of compromise when one's feeling so desperate is very, very difficult.
Mm.
And compromise sometimes works when people aren't that frightened.
Mm-hmm.
Frightened, I think that's the word you used, of losing what little they have. It may be better in that situation to say, okay, this time you stay home and I'll go out with them, which may be very unusual. Or I'll go with you this time and be with them, but next time I want my time. So it's a negotiation instead of a compromise. Compromise
right.
can work when people aren't as tight about it.
Right.
For example, a woman will say, I really want to go to the art gallery today. And the husband will say, I don't care what we do, I want to be with you.
Hmm.
That's my first choice. Let me see if I can work this out. But I'm not crazy about the art gallery. And she'll say, well, actually, I want to be with you, too. So let's talk about what we want to do together. That's compromising. And that can happen.
Sure.
But if someone comes with a first thing, I'm going to the art gallery this weekend, then that sets up an immediate, well, I'm not. That's the last thing I want to do. So then it goes back to, but I want to go to the art gallery. And then if someone can find the place to say, well, my first desire is to do something with you, I don't care what it is, then that shifts the whole conversation, and then compromise can happen.
Right. Yeah. So the next chapter is about bringing words of love to intimate moments. And I think, you know, there's a lot that can be said here. There's a lot that can be very challenging in those moments because, you know, again, different expectation, different needs, different wants, and you get to a place where, you know, it's for a lot of women, it's a very difficult topic. For a lot of men, I think it's a difficult topic. And it's just one of those funny areas that, you know, intimacy is so incredibly important. And yet, you know, talking about it is one of those, I guess, because it's considered so taboo. And I think maybe because we're so sexually repressed as a society, you know, we become obsessed with it. And there's just so many things with it.
Thank you for noticing. That's just about the tone I wanted to strike of these things can be talked about. Here are some easy ways to talk about them. We don't say enough, even though it is a sexually obsessed society, that in our most intimate relationships, sometimes we don't even realize we're not saying what's in our hearts. And so I didn't want to frighten people with it, though I might have with some of the conversations during sex. But I wanted to challenge them a little. So here's the responses I've had.
I bet they've been great.
Some friends read the book, and the woman came to me and she said, "I can't believe it. Bob's giving me all these compliments lately. He's telling me he really admires the way I've been working on my thesis and trying to get it done in time. And he never told me that before, and he told me I was beautiful. And I thought about it, and then I went back to him and I said, 'You've been reading Susan's book, haven't you?'" And he said, "Yes." However, it woke them up.
Wow.
And I was just delighted. Then another friend came to visit, and as he's leaving, and his wife's in the car, he yells at me across the street, "Susan, you're ruining our marriage. We never had these conversations before." And he didn't mean I was ruining his marriage. It meant, I believe, that he was challenged to open to conversations he never thought needed to be said. And yet, they might need to be said. Are you enjoying sex? Is this the way you want it? How could it be better for you? What would turn you on before we start? How would you like me to be turned on or act before we begin or as we're beginning to make love? These are things we don't say. We get into patterns. We do what we do and add a little variety here and there. But what if we dared to ask the other person, not complaining what isn't going well, but the how can it be better for you? What a sweet thing to ask.
Mm-hmm.
So that's what got me into that one, into those subjects.
Yeah, and you know, great topics to look at, because you brought up a range of different areas that, you know, from our fantasies to, you know, just keeping it alive. And I think, you know, it's all really, it's things to think about. And I hope that's exactly what it does.
You know, if I'd written this book 6 months later or finished it 6 months later, I would have added a whole piece that I think fits with your area, which is love making that includes being part of a larger spiritual, if that word is okay,
yeah,
a larger universe, that the love we bring to our intimate partner can expand and fill the world, and in turn we can take the healing energy of the universe and bring it into our bodies and bring it into our lovemaking and circulate it between us. I've been learning more about that in the months since I wrote the book, and I wished it included that kind of thinking, feeling, expressing.
I guess you have another book coming.
No, not at the moment. No, there's lots written on that. There's lots out there.
There is, yes. But it is again something to consider and to bring in part of your relationship.
Yeah, so, if it suits people. I mean, that is just too far out for some people.
Yeah,
I'm from California, and I'm moving more into that world, and it suits me. It suits my husband. I think it suits your listeners.
Mm-hmm.
But it's not for everyone, and you
Absolutely.
Have to pick and choose. Even within the words of the book, some things no one would ever consider saying,
mm-hmm.
and that's fine. Well, find what's worth works for you, and use it.
Yeah. Now I'm not sure what to talk about next, because there's so many things that are in the book. Divorce obviously is a huge issue. You know, what do you say to your children? What do you say to your children when they're adults?
I could jump in at this point if that's all right.
Yeah, absolutely.
What I tried to do with both divorce and adult children was to bring a new angle to the book, to the writing, slightly new which contrasts with what I said before, which is this is all stuff you know that I'm bringing forward. With divorce, I tried to give a few examples of people who did it and were friends sooner rather than later. People who did it consciously with their children, who didn't put their children between them. I think divorce is a huge, chaotic, incredibly painful act for both people. The shame that I heard when I talked with people, I did some specific interviews for the book. The shame was enormous. We are not supposed to do this. And I wanted them to know that people do it, and people do it so they don't end up feeling terrible about the way they did it, and that that's possible. So that was my angle on divorce. And also that you don't have to divorce just because somebody's had sex with another person.
Yeah.
Sometimes you do, and sometimes that's the message. But there's a lot of conversations that have to happen to find out what was the meaning of this other relationship. Where did you want me to fit into this? What are you saying about our relationship? How would you like me to change so this works better for you? Do you want to continue with me? Can I trust you to continue in this relationship? A lot needs to be said. The knee-jerk, I'm out of here, doesn't do very much for me.
Mm-hmm.
And then with adult children, I was, for a time in my life, hearing from clients and friends about adult children that take what I now call a time out from their families. And each set of parents felt so alone and so hurt by this. Why is my child, who I adore so much, saying, I don't want to see you, I don't want to talk to you, for without much reason? And so I began collecting these stories, and I wrote a few of them in there, and how people got back together, and that they did get back together in most cases, not all. And I don't think it's something that's been written about much.
Mm-hmm.
And so I was... part of the reason for writing the book was to explore that area and let people know it does happen, and that in my experience, the young people that do it, I try to write it from both their point of view and the parents, but the young people are often saying, I've been loved too much. I need to differentiate. I need to find out who I am. I need to know what I'm thinking before I know what you're thinking about this subject. I don't want so much coming at me from you. I want to be more self-reliant.
Mm-hmm.
And parents have to learn to back off and let that happen and not clamor that to chase a child who is distancing an adult child, they're in their 20s for the most part, to chase that child is only going to push them further away, and that there are ways and ways of patiently saying, I'm here if you want me, and I'm not going to reach out to you, and not sending money and not sending Christmas cards and birthday cards. And it's really hard, and not phoning and not saying, well, just phone me on Sundays, it's not going to work. The more space they have, the sooner they'll turn around and say, hey, how are you guys? What's going on? I haven't heard from you. But it takes a real backing off and enormous patience and tremendous support from each of the parents, the mother and father, who need to support each other enormously to get through it.
Yeah. And I've known people who have done that, and you know, I know how difficult it is on both, but from both sides, because I've seen, I know the parents, and I know, you know, the son who did it, and you know, I know that it's difficult on both sides.
What would he have said? Am I allowed to ask you questions?
Sure. I mean, in this case, it was, you know, he was going through a divorce, and he didn't want any interruption at that time. And then he kind of got some outside interference that suggested that, you know, he needed this break. And I think that interfered a little bit with some of his decisions. And although, you know, they have reconnected to some point, you know, there's still been some, there's still things that need to be worked on. Which, you know, is uncomfortable for both.
And that would be an important time, a time of divorce or some other kind of trauma in the adult child's life that they want to handle on their own.
Mm-hmm.
And that has to be okay.
Yeah.
You know, I gave you my diamond in the beginning, and across the fat middle, there's listening, acceptance, compassion. I want to add respect.
Mm.
The respect that we would give a friend we owe to our children.
Yes.
And to our parents. Too often we think we can... push in and put out our point of view strongly with other generations. in a way we never would with our friends, and it needs to be done. We can put out our views, but it's better to wait to be asked or to ask, would you like my opinion on this? Mm. Would you like me to tell you where I am on it? And often the answer is no, and that has to be accepted.
Yeah.
And I think of how vulnerable I was as a young bride and how I wanted to get everything right. And, interference just, it wasn't well-intended, kind, useful advice would just drive me up the wall.
Yeah.
Just had to do it my way for a while and see that I knew something. And then I could hear my mother and my mother-in-law.
Mm-hmm.
And they didn't seem to remember they'd once been new mothers.
Yeah.
So I want to remind all the readers, remember when you were a new mother? Did you want to be told to cover your baby? Be told to take your baby home from the supermarket? She looks tired. That's nobody else's business.
So. Yeah. And then let's briefly talk, since we're coming to a close, about your last chapter, which is, you know, the decisions we make, you know, at the end of life, which can be difficult.
Yes. And they can be difficult and exacerbated because I know if I have a cold, I don't make as good judgments as I do when I'm healthy.
Very well said.
So think of ourselves, if we think of ourselves, at the end of life with many kinds of minor difficulties or major difficulties, incapacities, limited functioning, and how different we are from the person we were at 50 or 60. And we feel crummy and we're on medication. How can we make judgment calls for ourselves? And yet, this is a time when I say the next generation may need to step up and overstep some of that respect I was just talking about in order to help make decisions that serve the person who's ill or dying.
Yeah.
And finding that balance between respect and caregiving, honoring the parent's need and desire to make their own decisions, and yet letting them know, well, I think that I need to have some input on this, is very delicate, because we want to have our parent go out, or our, any older person we know, we want to have a good relationship as the dying process begins and as they die.
Mm-hmm.
And how to do that is really touchy when someone's trying to be very self-reliant and people around them don't feel they can. And there's also a very tricky time when siblings disagree on how a parent should be cared for,
yeah,
when a parent's no longer making the decisions.
Mm-hmm.
So again, I return to listening with interest, curiosity, and respect to other people's points of view. I've heard terrible stories around end of life where one brother knows that mother wants to die at home and another brother doesn't care if she wants to die at home, and he calls the ambulance. And once an ambulance is called, they have to take the person.
Right.
So a woman in a group I was leading said, you put up on your door before you crawl into bed, do not remove this person from this home, and sign it. And maybe then they won't take you out if someone should happen to call an ambulance. This is a really big issue for people.
Yeah. And I like the one story in, you know, that you talked about where, you know, the woman knew she was dying, but everybody was so being so nice to her.
Oh, Suzanne. Mm. Yeah. That was so sweet. I'll just basically repeat what you said, which is that she knew she was dying. She had metastasized breast cancer, and she'd finished all treatments, and she was very weak. And nobody would say the word, and no one would talk to her about it. She was in a hospital, and she was happy to be in a hospital at that point. She was on a respirator, I think.
Yeah.
I knew she was using oxygen part of the day, and her family, huge family, kept coming in and out of the room and then going to the waiting room to cry. And finally she said to a young woman who was her daughter-in-law-to-be, that is one of the most extraneous relatives that was coming in and out, she said, why won't people talk to me about this? And the young girl said, well, we don't know what to say, and we didn't know you knew, and we wanted to protect you. She said, I've got to talk about this. So the young woman went back to the waiting room and said to the family what she had heard, and they came in and began conversing with her. Another person that can be very helpful at that time is hospice workers. They know how to get families talking to each other. They know how to help the person who's dying begin to face the fact that they're dying. Now, some people choose at the end of life to not talk about it. Mm-hmm. And that has to be their choice, I think. It's hard, but I think it is their choice. But then the family members, once they know, can talk among themselves and grieve together before the death and hold each other and mourn together.
Right.
And if it can be done with the person who's dying, that is a collective experience that's incredibly sweet and treasured.
Mm-hmm.
And it takes a little extension of self and of reading. That is an intuitive time of mind reading, of determining whether this is a person who really doesn't want to talk or would like to be drawn out, like Suzanne wanted to be drawn out.
Right.
She needed someone to say to her, what's it like in there? What's it like to be lying here knowing these are your last days?
Mm-hmm.
How are you dealing with that?
Yeah.
She would have liked that.
Yeah.
So that's also why I end the book with that story. I think it's so touching and so mm-hmm. true.
Yeah, it's beautiful.
Yeah.
Well, Susan, it has been a lovely interview, and I hope people get this book because it does go through a lot of different scenarios, and it makes you think, and it hopefully will let people, you know, have more heart, compassionate relationships and conversations. And I think that's really what this is all about.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure for me also. Your reflections and thoughts and questions. I've really enjoyed the hour with you.
Great. All right. Well, thank you very much.
Thank you, Ari.
Okay.
Bye now.
Bye.